Taxidermy has been at the center of controversy for as long as its existence. What is considered for some the conservation of knowledge and others the preservation of beauty, of nature and of life is seen as unethical, cruel and blatant act of disrespect towards the deceased animal for many. As an art, it is often viewed as morbid, fascinating and above all, intriguing. It is an art form that has changed and evolved over the centuries. Whether you are for or against taxidermy, it is undeniable that it has extended beyond simply being a popular element of interior design or a display of trophies. Today, it serves its role as educators of past and of extant in natural history museums. As the medium, the muse, and the subject of many contemporary artists as live animal doubles in films, commercials and music videos, as decoration of showcases, displays and much more. Taxidermy is really emerging as a new art form, but we don't really know all about it. So let's take a look at what real life taxidermy has to say about it. I invited Sydney from the UK so she could tell us about taxidermy in more depth. See, I cannot even think to begin this podcast without asking this question to you. So Sydney, tell me this. Where do you get these animals from? I mean, this question is something that every taxidermist has been asked once. And everyone has different answers. So what's yours?
So I have a mixture of sources where I get my animals from. In the beginning, when I first started out, it was a lot from roadkill. That would be my main source. But as I've kind of, you know, developed and grown contacts and relationships with people that can provide these like breeders, rehabilitation centres, zoos, all that, or other taxidermists even, I get a lot of birds and animals from those, and just general people that see something on the side of the road or have one of their animals, like, you know, ducks or waterfowl that pass away, or game shoots as well. When the season's open, I get birds from there.
That's great. So, I mean, you are so young, and how did you, you know, what I'm searching for is when did you found out that taxidermy is your thing? I mean, there must be a eureka moment or something.
Yeah, it's funny because I've always, since a young age, I've always had a passion for animals and wildlife. I've always had pets when around the house and things, and I've always, you know, if the cat would bring in something that was still alive, I'd try and, you know, rescue it so it could go out back to the wild. I've always had that love and calling for wildlife. So it was when I was about 8 years old, I saw my dad's friend. He had in his house his own taxidermy fox that I was really fascinated with. And from then, that kind of caught my attraction. You know, I had an understanding of what it was. And so I went out of my own way to start my own collection. But as you know, as a young child, I didn't have a lot of money in taxidermy, especially the good pieces are quite expensive. So I learned about how to do it. And from there, I practiced on, you know, easily accessible things like squirrels and crows, things like that at 8. But for my 13th birthday, I had a proper professional course with a taxidermist. And that set me off really. And from 13 to now, I've been doing it semi-professionally and consistently as well.
That's great. You told me that you get all these animals from, you know, from different places and from different organizations and different taxidermists. So is there any laws regarding taxidermy in UK?
Yeah, there are a few. As far as the UK goes, though, we're quite relaxed on different, you know, different animals. But ones we are strict with are birds of prey. If they're on the Appendix A CITES list, they need a certificate, an A10 certificate, which just kind of proves that no foul play was involved in the death of the animal. And it just allows us to then sell commercially as well. So it kind of, it kills off the drive for like illegal trading and stuff like that. So that's for the birds of prey. But swans, otters and bats in particular in the UK, we can't have any possession of them without a GL02 license, and that allows us to do the animal only for museum or educational purposes. For so for me, a taxidermist that's not working with a museum organisation, I wouldn't be allowed to have any sort of possession of a bat, swan or otter. And if I did, it would have to be in a certain time frame where I would then have to gift it to a taxidermist who does have that licence. So on the spectrum of laws, that's the only sort of regulations that we do have.
I mean, yes, if you are intending to sell or buy a rare or endangered taxidermy animal or any part of such an animal, it is important that you are fully aware of the Convention of International Trade in, you know, endangered species. Because, you know, the penalty for breaking this law can be severe. Anyways, you know, when I was working around on the internet, finding what topic I should do a podcast on, I came across to an article. And the headline of the article really struck into my mind. Why do taxidermists deny to work on pets?
I agree with them. I won't work on pets. The only pets I will work on is birds, because I feel with a cat or a dog, you know, you've known that animal all its life. You've known it for 12, 15 years. And it comes with a personality and a character. And I think trying to capture that into a still piece is really difficult, and it's quite pressurizing for the taxidermist. That comes with a lot of responsibility and expectation from the client side that they will get their pet back. But in reality, you're not getting your pet, you're not getting the character and the animal that you know, you're just getting an empty shell of it back. And I think that's why a lot of taxidermists won't work on pets, because they don't want to, you know, tread on boundaries that could upset anyone or fail to meet expectations. So that's my personal reasons, and I think that's a lot of other taxidermists too.
They don't really want to disappoint their client.
No, definitely not.
Yeah, that's understandable. There's one more thing that I would like to, you know about taxidermists that I've talked to, you know, few other taxidermists who usually practice that. So they do believe that hunting their own animal that they will later work on is a good thing.
Yeah. So I think, I guess it all ties in with a person's ethics as well. And I think hunting for the art of taxidermy is quite a historical thing now, especially since a lot of taxidermists, although they do hunt, they only do it within the season. They then use all parts of the animal. I think now it's less about the hunting and the trophy, but more about the preservation of the art and kind of, I think definitely the taxidermists now, their viewpoints have changed significantly since the first few taxidermists and kind of the historical aspects of it all.
That sounds great. I mean, I also remember a time when hunting was not prohibited in India. I mean, you know, there used to be a lot of taxidermists around here too. But since hunting has been prohibited, so, you know, the number of taxidermists has also been decreased significantly. So the thing is, the one thing that makes me wonder is how do you, you know, get around the wound that is caused by the gunshot?
So it's quite surprising. It's only very little, kind of like the entrance wound, and there's not often a exit wound. So if it's shot humanely, and it should be quite a clean kill and a clean kind of wound as well. So, and if it is big, it's just a case of sewing up as discreetly as possible, or positioning the animal in a way that it doesn't show its damaged side, because sometimes fur or feathers can be lost. And especially in the UK, we have dogs that retrieve the birds. So, you know, in their mouths, the feathers come out, and it's just positioning it in a way that kind of hides it and shows off its best side.
Mm-hmm. The cause of death should be natural, in short.
Yeah, definitely. I don't want to associate myself with anything that's come about death in a unhumane or kind of cruel way. So, you know, what, I only accept natural deaths or things that have been put down humanely as it can be. So yeah, I don't agree with any sort of harm coming to animals that will make it suffer.
So is there any criteria that you look for when an animal reaches out to you? I mean, do you look for a wound or something that, you know, makes you sure that, yeah, you would be able to work on this one?
So with a lot of things that I do, it's really important the skull is intact, because I try the hardest that I can, especially with birds, to keep the skull in. It keeps, you know, nice shape, and it keeps that original structure there. So if the skull's completely smashed, it makes the job much more difficult and often not really worth my time. Other things is, if the animal has been dead for a long time and bacteria's got to it, it can cause the hair to slip, and it leaves big bald patches. So things that have gone off too long and they're losing their fur often means it's not really salvageable and not worth my time either. So those, I think those two are the big main things, because other broken bones can be fixed with, you know, wires and things, or taken out completely, and blood and all that is just washed away. So
So I recently watched the recent post that you uploaded of the peacock. I mean, that was beautiful work there. How did it get to you, the peacock? Oh,
thank you. I'm not actually sure how it died. It was only a young bird, 2 years, so not full maturity yet. But it came from a person I know. He had it in his freezer. He's, you know, he's friendly among the taxidermists, and I think it may have come from, you know, big stately homes. They often have peacocks around, or a breeder, or just somewhere that had peacocks. So he had it, and he then offered it onto me for a small price to cover postage. And then I came in the possession of it, and I did it up yesterday. Quite a job. It took me all day to get it to a point where it looked, you know, the best that I could have done it. So I was really pleased with the outcome, since it was my first peacock as well, and they're quite difficult birds to do.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you do a bird or an animal, how long do you expect it to last?
So once it's completely finished and it's cared for properly, it should last as long as it can, really. So I have a few pieces in my home that are over 100 years old. So, and they've been cared for, so they're still in good condition, like they were, you know, done recently. So as long as it is looked after, you know, dusted down every now and then, and kept away from direct sunlight and insects, they last as long as time, really. So there's no specific time span.
So they are truly preserved in time.
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's such a valuable thing as well to have.
That's great. The thing yet that you told about bacteria, if a bird dies of so-called disease XYZ, how are you sure that that disease won't get you?
So once I have a possession of a bird, I freeze it. So that kills off any parasites, any lice, and it should kill off any disease as well that is in the bird or on the bird's skin. But if it's not, I always take precautions anyway. I'll wear gloves. I'll keep it as far away from my face as possible, you know, keep any like fluids away from, you know, I often cut myself with the scalpel, so if that happens, I'll wash my hands immediately, wrap it up with a plaster, and then put gloves back on to keep myself, you know, as safe as possible from whatever the bird or the animal may be carrying. And then obviously once I've finished, I wash my hands completely and disinfect everything, all the different surfaces and all my tools as well, to just eliminate that risk completely.
That's great. I mean, that sounds really risky to me. I mean, you know, in the times of pandemic, how can one not take care of hygiene?
Yeah, I think it is really, it's quite important to, especially, you know, if you go and interact with other people as well, you just don't want to catch anything or spread it on to anyone else.
The taxidermy has been, you know, around for around 300 to 400 years now. And as long as it has been on the paper officially, there are a lot of changes that have been, you know, adopted by taxidermists and the art they perform. So are there any particular changes that you have seen in your experience of 9 years?
Well, the one that I've noticed, I'm part of an organization in the UK of taxidermists. One that I've noticed is the demographic of it is changing. So it was mainly just older men, but now it's becoming more younger women who are taking on the art and kind of encouraging that further for other people. That's one, I think, one main change that I've noticed. And as for the method that we use, that's always constantly changing. You know, hundreds of years ago, they would have used shredded up wood will, the same way that I use that method, but now more modernized ways of doing it have come in, so you can buy commercial forms that are already in the shape and the dimensions and the pose of the animal that you want. You can just purchase them and then, you know, adjust them as needed, put the skin on, and then you have a mount that's already been done in such a shorter amount of time than if you were to make it yourself. So I think that is a substantial change that's happened over the years, and it's becoming quite a popular way of doing it, especially for those animals that are bigger, you know, like deer and big cats, things like that.
That really makes things easier.
It does, yeah. It makes it easier if you know what you're doing with the forms. I've used forms a few times and I've not really gotten on with them, because if you don't know what you're doing with them, they're quite difficult to kind of understand, and they're quite rigid as well, so it's hard to get any movement.
Those companies who are, you know, manufacturing these forms, do they, you know, ask for the size of the board or something or before you give them order? I mean, what's the process of that?
So the ones that, there's a website I buy all my supplies off, and he has already made forms that state the dimensions, and what I do as well, when I have a bird or whatever I'm working on, I measure what I need, the different parts of the animal. I make measurements of that. So when I make my own form, I have that in mind. So taxidermists will often have the measurements of what they're working on already, and then they'll go up onto the website and look through all the different forms that have the mannequins on with their measurements. And sometimes they're not accurate, sometimes they're not as close as you'd want them, but you'd find the one that's closest and then either take away or build onto it to get the best product that you can from it.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I mean, that should really reduce a lot of amount of time, you know, that has been invested by a taxidermist into, you know, making of the form and all.
Yeah, a lot of time is invested into it. You know, I spend a lot of my spare time, and quite a lot of money goes into them as well, because these things, you know, they're expensive. Some forms I've seen go for several hundred pounds, and you know, you have to buy mouth sets and eyes and other things that go into it. Makes it quite costly.
Can you give me an estimate of, I mean, how much, you know, a small bird can cost you?
So things like crows, things like that, they cost me around £15. Mm-hmm. That covers eyes and, you know, wood, wool, wires, things like that. So on that scale, and then I would obviously sell it at my retail price. That seems quite sustainable and cost effective, you know, kind of turnaround. But things that are slightly bigger, you know, the peacock was more expensive. I had to buy the bird, the eyes, make the body have more wire. That cost me about £60 to £70.
Mm-hmm.
So bigger things are generally more expensive, but the prices that you then sell it at should, hopefully, you'd hope, cover the cost of what it makes. But you've also got to consider your time into it and the cost that your time is, you know, costing you. So
you have worked on both animals and birds, yeah?
Yes, I have.
So what's the main difference in between those both, and I mean, working on both these species?
So I find birds a lot more rewarding. You know, I don't have to put in as much laborious work into working with the skin. So mammals, they have a lot more muscle and kind of fine membranes on the skin that you then have to strip down completely. So just down to the hair follicle, and then tan. And tans can take, you know, up to a week to do. As for a bird, I can skin a bird and mount it in a day. I find it a lot more rewarding, and I have more of an interest in birds as well. I think it helps that I was taught on birds, so I'm familiar with them. But mm-hmm. I think mammals, they have so much more demand in the structure of their face and their body that I just don't really want to spend my time too much on when I could be perfecting my birds, I think.
So you've been perfecting in the birds especially?
Yeah, I think that's what I'd like to specialize in.
So what's the hardest part of doing bird? I mean, you have done, what, hundreds of birds, right?
Yeah, I must have. I've lost count now, but I must have.
So what's the hardest part of doing that?
I think, So what I found is skinning a bird is all pretty much the same, no matter what bird you work on. They all have their differences, but the process is all the same. But I think what's difficult is then putting that skin onto a body that I've made and making it look lifelike, you know, getting the anatomy correct, the wing placement right, the leg, you know, the leg placement, and then the angle of the eye to the wing to the leg, and then the tail. It's all quite quite a laborious process, and you've got to really know your anatomy and definitely know kind of bird behavior, and you want to capture that personality and the attitude in a still piece, which I think is probably very difficult to kind of portray a story in a picture in something that's dead and doesn't have a life anymore, but it's trying to replicate that life it did have.
That's great. The animal that you worked on should last as long the time is, right? If it has been taken care of. So, I mean, according to you, what is the most hardest part? I mean, working on the project or taking care of it?
I definitely think working on it is the hardest part, because taking one, if it's been done correctly, it should just sit in the corner of your room with occasional, you know, occasional dust and a gloss over the eyes. But if it's not done correctly, if you've not stripped all the fat and then flesh away from the skin, they can deteriorate quite quickly because bugs can get in and they'll rot. So definitely putting the time into doing them and putting them together is the hardest part.
So you have worked on hundreds of birds. So do you have most of them, or you sell them, or, you know, give them to the museums or for educational purposes or something?
So the first few that I did do, I kept them for a while because when I was younger, you know, that I was proud of them. But, you know, as of recently, I found them and I've been quite embarrassed about them. So a lot of them have gone in the bin. Some I sell. I sell a lot to clients, either through commissions or commissioned work or stock. So a lot I sell or... there's obviously a few, you know, the rarer birds that I don't want to part with just yet. I keep for my own collection. So it's a mixture of keeping them and selling them or binning them if they've just not turned out right.
That's great. But, you know, what makes me wonder is, what do you guys do except the skin part? I mean, what do you do with that? Where does it go?
So the insides, they, if we can't eat them, if they're not for human consumption because they've, you know, I don't know how they've died, etc. I'll either put them in the food waste bin, or if we can, if it's safe to, we'll go to kind of, you know, the outdoors, like up a mountain or in the forest, and we'll put the body there. So it's not in plain sight, but it's somewhere where other organisms can, you know, benefit and flourish from there. But If that's only if it's something like, you know, a fox or a squirrel that we can't eat. Things like pheasants and ducks, my family will cook and eat, since, you know, I don't eat meat, so it's for them to enjoy.
So you are telling me that you are a taxidermist who is a vegan?
Yeah, that's right.
That's good, man. That's great. So according to you, what is the best part of taxidermy?
I just love the kind of feeling of completion when I've finished a bird that I've been, you know, nervous to do or excited to do, or one that's been really frustrating, is having that finished piece turn out how I want, and that kind of sense of accomplishment that, yes, I did that. That's, I think that's really, really worthwhile. And especially when it's something personal for someone else, if it's, you know, their pet bird, it's really nice to see them happy with their piece that they've, you know, we've built a relationship over, to communicating how they want it and and all this, and built a close, you know, customer relationship with. It's really nice to see that my work's paid off and made someone else happy as well. I think that's the main thing for me.
So, I mean, are there any myths that you want to debunk about the taxidermist? I mean, I'm from a commerce background, and there are a bunch of myths out there that I would like to debunk. But you are a professional taxidermist, so I mean, you must be coming around and some usual myths, some very small, but.
I'm not sure if it's a myth, but there's a perception, I think, and a stigma around taxidermy. I think a lot of people who may not really know that much about it are very quick to jump that all taxidermists kill their animals and we are animal killers, when in reality, I think it's the complete opposite. We all have a love for animals and we all have that passion and want to. I think taxidermists are one of the people that have probably the most respect for, our nature and our wildlife, because we want to encourage people to learn from it and learn from history as well, through representing those animals in a respectful way, also allowing us to educate people and give people the opportunities to see things that us humans have made extinct, things like the Thylacine or the barbarian lion, stuff like that. Those don't exist anymore, only through taxidermy. And I think it's a misconception that we want to kill those animals to stuff, when in reality we'd much prefer them alive, but it's just the way things are at the minute.
It is what it is.
It is, but can't change everyone's views.
So I believe we should leave them with their
So
own
I believe
perspective
we
and
should
what they
leave
believe.
them with
I
their
mean,
own perspective
we
and
really
what they
know what
believe.
it means
I
and
mean,
what it
we
really
really
know
know
what
what
it means
I
and
think
what
this
it
is
really
it for
stands
this
for.
podcast.
So I think
I hope
this is
every
it
listener
for this
enjoyed
podcast.
this
I hope
conversation.
every listener enjoyed
And yeah,
this conversation.
I think this would be it.
And yeah,
I
thanks for
think this would
joining
be
in.
it.
And I'll see you in the next
Thanks for joining
podcast.
in.
Till
And I'll
then,
see you in the next
stay safe,
podcast.
appreciate
Till then,
art,
stay
and live
safe,
your life.
appreciate art, and live your life.